This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, less than 6 months after losing its hold on Turkey's parliament, the ruling Justice and Development Party, or AKP, won a stunning and decisive victory in the nation's recent snap elections. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Analysts say this result marks a considerable political coup for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who has been at the helm of the country for 13 years and now looks likely to further entrench his rule. The AKP captured just under 50% of the vote, which translates to 316 out of a total of 550 seats. The main opposition party, the Republican People's Party, or CHP, won just over 25%, while the HDP, the liberal pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, surpassed a 10% legal threshold to enter parliament, but it declined from the June high of 13%. We'll talk with our analysts about the results, how they were achieved, and what this all means for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's grip on power and the future of NATO member Turkey's domestic, regional, and foreign policies. Kadir Üstün, he's executive director at the Foundation for Political, Economic, and Social Research, SETA, and that's a Turkish think tank based here in Washington. And Blaise Mistal, he's director of the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center, a think tank also based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Good to be with you, Carol.
Well, Blaise Mistal, let me begin with you because you just came back from Istanbul. You were in Turkey. You observed the elections, even if unofficially. What is the significance of this do-over and the stunning results for Turkey? Were you surprised?
Well, I think everybody was surprised. The election result was quite far from what any of the polls were predicting, what anybody on the street was really expecting. But it was significant because for the last 5 months, Turkey has officially been in a virtual standstill. It's been racked by political uncertainty. It's had an interim government uncertain of what direction the country would take. And in some way, just answering that question, who's going to rule and what's going to happen in Turkey, was an important one. So it was a breakthrough moment. The question is, what direction will that breakthrough go?
Indeed. Well, for that, let me turn now to Kadir Üstün for your take on the election, what direction you think it's going to go. Some say that President Erdogan has now further entrenched his rule. He's calling for a new constitution that would even give him more executive power. Again, your take on the election results.
After the June elections, we had a coalition-forming period, which failed, essentially. None of the opposition parties were able to form a coalition with the ruling AK Party, and then the country went to snap elections in November. But in the meantime, PKK restarted the fighting with the government, and in the Kurdish regions in the east, there was a lot of concern about the fighting. But the Justice and Development Party was able to present itself as the sort of beacon of stability and coalition government's hazards for Turkey from the past, from the 90s, etc. And people were unhappy with the opposition parties. They didn't present a serious alternative, which is why an overwhelming majority of the electorate went back to AK Party. But going forward, this is not enough for AK Party to change the constitution on its own. So it will still have to come to an agreement with opposition parties on changing the constitution and potentially moving to a semi-presidential or presidential system. We'll see how that will play out, but the AK Party needs the opposition votes for that.
And of course, you were referring to PKK, and that's the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, with which the AK Party, or the ruling party, had a peace deal going on. This started about 3 years ago, but that, of course, broke down in July, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. But now back to you, Blaise Mistal, to talk about how President Erdogan accomplished this goal. The New York Times editorial, for example, said Erdogan's scare tactics paid off. Did he, in your view, engage in scare tactics? Many say that the campaign was marred by this military crackdown on Kurdish communities on the pretext that they were attacking the outlawed PKK. And then there's also a lot of intimidation of journalists who are critical of Erdogan. Your view?
Well, first of all, it certainly worked, whatever it is. When you look at the election result in November compared to June, the AK Party got almost 5 million more votes. That's 8.5% and far exceeds anything that we saw in the opinion polls. In fact, the highest opinion poll gave the AK party 47%, but clearly something worked. And as Kadir, I think, rightly observed, it was a yearning for stability, and it was an appeal to stability that the AK party made to its voters. But as I think you hinted at, Carol, the lack of stability that left voters yearning for stability was something that was created by the AK party in the first place. And so when you say that the opposition parties had nothing to offer, that's also true because, in fact, in some ways, the AK party was holding the country hostage. There was the conflict that was ongoing since July with the PKK, despite the fact that the PKK had offered a ceasefire ahead of the elections that wasn't observed by the government. And you had multiple firings of journalists, imprisoning of journalists, and actually in the days right before the election, you had the takeover of critical media outlets by the government through a court decision, but imposed through baton and tear gas-wielding police who went into the offices of an opposition media outlet and forcibly evicted the management and the journalists, and then basically changed the editorial stance of those papers and TV stations. So there was a fair amount of instability. There was also an economic slide during this time, and all of that people saw as something that was bad, but also something being instigated by the AK party. And so the best way to stop it is give them what they wanted, which was back to power.
Turning back to you, Kadir Üstün, for your take on what the Turkish electorate wants, and is there some sort of trade-off between stability and rights, freedom of expression, rule of law, and so forth? We're seeing a lot of criticism coming out of the EU and the United States about this repression of journalists that's going on, particularly by the AK party. What about the Turkish electorate? How do they feel about that?
Well, obviously, I would take issue with the idea that AK party was responsible for, at least in the eyes of the electorate, millions and millions of people. It was not AK party's fault. Actually, PKK restarted the fight soon after the June elections, and they actually undermined HDP, which is the political party for Kurdish rights. They undermined the Kurdish political movement at that level. And then we saw on the part of the ultranationalist MHP, the party becoming a party of no. Nobody knew what they wanted. And then CHP tried to form a bloc along with other opposition parties against the AK party, which failed. So when the opposition parties could not get their act together and find common ground among themselves, it was clear to the electorate, without AK party, you couldn't do anything. And that wasn't a scare tactic or fear tactic. When there were attacks by the ISIS and PKK, Turkey accepted U.S. proposal to open the Incirlik airbase and then started a dual campaign against ISIL and PKK at the same time. So the electorate felt that opposition parties failed and there were these terrorist groups who were trying to bring down the government. So I would take issue with that point.
But with Blaise's point. Well, actually, what I was asking was not...
I was talking
more about the media repression, not really about how they dealt
media,
with the stability.
It's been a couple years now. Media has been part of the political fight in Turkey. And when you look at the opposition papers, how many they sell and etc., they exceed pro-government papers. That doesn't justify any pressure on the media. But the point is, media has been part of a political fight instrumentalized by various groups who are trying to advance their political aims. And we are seeing a narrower space for press freedom.
And who's responsible for that?
I would say everybody. You have papers who are closely aligned with certain movements, like the Gulen movement and other interest groups, who, if you read Turkish, you'll see these headlines that are attacking politicians personally and swearing at them even. One of them called Erdogan a murderer. So we have a very bad situation in terms of media freedom in Turkey, but that's because the media as a whole has been instruments in this political fight in Turkey in the midst of this political instability.
We'll have more on the fallout from the recent Turkish elections, but first, a short break. We'll be right back.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back to Encounter. We're talking about the fallout from the most recent Turkish parlamentary election. So back to you, Blaise Miçtal, to talk about the results on the Kurdish side. We saw the HDP party, which is primarily a Kurdish party, which also attracts other more liberal voters or those who are disenchanted perhaps with other political parties, particularly the AK Party. What does this mean for them? They made the 10% threshold for parliament, but has the party been damaged, particularly given Erdogan's tendency to sort of conflate the PKK, the outlawed Kurdish party, with the whole, you know, Kurdish population?
Well, I think, first of all, it is important to note that for the first time a Kurdish party, or I guess now officially the second time, but entering into a lasting parliament for the first time, a Kurdish party will be in parliament. It has crossed the 10% threshold, which is a historic moment for Turkey, and one that really should be celebrated and marks a major advance for the country. But the HDP find themselves in a very difficult situation with one key asset. The difficult situation is the following. They have made enemies of both the government and the PKK, as sort of one might think about as their militant base, and threading the needle between the Erdogan government, which at one point in time was trying to pursue peace with the Kurds and was trying to give the Kurds a greater political role in the country, and saw them as political partners, but no longer feels that way, it would appear, and between the PKK, who see the HDP as traitors to the cause of Kurdish nationalism. So they're really sort of between a Scylla and a Charybdis in terms of their political situation. They do have one major asset, which is the co-leader of the party, Saad Demirtas, who is a very charismatic, affable, and able political leader, and perhaps really the only other political figure in Turkey's landscape other than Erdogan, who is able to capture much allegiance in a country where charismatic leadership matters and cults of personalities matter. Demirtas is really the only other figure that might be able to rival, not at this point in time, but somewhere down the line, Erdogan.
Turning to you, Kadir Ustun, where do these elections now leave the HDP, the Liberal Pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, which did surpass the legal threshold for 10%? It's in parliament, but somewhat tarnished. Where do they go from here?
The thing that they weren't able to accomplish was to distance themselves from PKK as a political party. That wasn't just expectation of a Turkish electorate, but also Kurdish electorate, because we saw a whole million votes move away from HDP. And in the Kurdish region, AK Party became competitive with them once again, largely because in the region, PKK tried to establish de facto autonomous cities and tried to make people rise up against the government, which failed because people are voting nationalistically perhaps for HDP, but they're not necessarily happy about PKK's tactics. But HDP continues to command that kind of nationalist vote, and it's critical for Turkey, of course, to arrive at a final political resolution to this process. But I think the government going forward will make a distinction between fighting the PKK and giving rights to Kurds at home. HDP will continue to struggle, largely because their base, as Blaise was saying, that militant base on the part of PKK, they can't quite distinguish themselves from them, and PKK leaders are able to come out and scold Demirtas. So it is a problem for them, and I think they're going to have to chart a new course, how to look like a party of Turkey. That was their promise, and I think they failed to some extent to fulfill that promise in the past 5 months.
Let's now turn to the Syria conundrum. So back to you, Blaise Miçtal. What do these elections mean now for Turkey's policy towards Syria? We know that there seems to be a clash between Turkey's approach to the conflict and the United States, because the United States has now sort of partnered with the PYD, the Syrian Kurdish Party, which is very effective in fighting against ISIL, also known as Daesh. But at the same time, Turkey sees the PYD as a threat, seeing them as somehow aligned with the PKK, and notwithstanding Turkey allowing the United States to use Turkish bases for attacks on Daesh. How do you see this playing out?
Well, as you suggest, Carol, this question of foreign policy in Syria is really caught up with the Kurdish question inside of Turkey. both for Turkey itself and for the United States. For Turkey, because President Erdogan and the ruling AKP do not distinguish between the PKK and the PYD. In fact, not only has Turkey been attacking the Kurds within Turkish borders, it's pursued them into northern Iraq, which is a traditional base of operations for the PKK, but has also attacked PYD outposts in Syria. And President Erdogan has said, for Turkey, our primary threat is the PKK and not ISIS. For the U.S., this matters because the PYD is a partner for us on the ground. We have been providing arms and air support to the PYD. They are part of Secretary Carter's new strategy to retake the ISIS capital of Raqqa. We are embedding U.S. Special Operations Forces on the ground with the Syrian Kurds. But the Syrian Kurds care about what happens in Turkey, too. And so they're not going to be distinguishing between U.S. policies in support of them and U.S. policies in support of Erdogan, who they see as targeting their brethren. And so this attempt that the U.S. has been making to distinguish, to have two different policies, sort of say Turkey has a right to protect itself from the PKK, but we see the PYD is different and we're going to be friendly with them, that's ultimately going to be something that Turkey doesn't accept and is something the PYD is not going to accept that distinction either.
Turning back to you, Kadir Üstün, for your take on Turkey's Syria policy for so many years, and one could argue very rightly so, Turkey, Erdogan in particular, has been very much anti-Assad. Assad is seen as the root of the problem, even a magnet for the likes of Daesh or ISIS. At the same time, we understand there may be a shift going on. He would consider perhaps a transition phase for Assad until a new government or an election. How do you see Turkish policy toward Syria and the rift that this can cause between the United States and Turkey, two major NATO allies?
Past several years, we've seen convergence and divergence between the U.S. and Turkey regarding Syria. And right now, there's more convergence than divergence, I would say, especially at the diplomatic level. Russian broker talks may yield to some sort of transition plan, which Turkey is part of those discussions. Hopefully, that diplomatic track will produce something. But since it's been a while, we've had a actual diplomatic track. Turkey has been more focused on the refugee issue and the border security and the threats that PKK poses across the border. Turkey has seen PKK as the main threat, of course, focused on that, but it didn't see necessarily ISIS as a less of a threat, especially regarding their activities in Syria. Turkey sees PYD as an extension of PKK, but it does make that distinction. Turkey's red line there is for them to not go across to the west of the Euphrates River, but Turkey has not seriously attacked PYD in Syria. But it sees the organic links with PKK and especially concerned about arms of PYD going back to PKK camps in Iraq and being moved into Turkey to be used against Turkish security forces. That's why I think discussions have been ongoing for a long time between U.S. and Turkey about how to approach PYD. But the U.S. essentially sees a capable fighting partner in PYD against ISIL, but Turkey is also concerned about their political aims and then the arms that they're given to be used against Turkey.
Indeed. We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Kadir Üstün, from whom you just heard. He's Executive Director at the Foundation for Political, Economic, and Social Research, or SETA. That's a Turkish think tank based in Washington. And Blaise Mistal, he's Director of the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center. That's a centrist think tank based here in Washington. We're discussing the implications of the recent snap elections in Turkey. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Wali Darvishi from Herat, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. Well, back to you, Blaise Mistal, to talk about the refugee situation. Turkey has been exemplary in sheltering millions of refugees, and they rightly need more help. So now this is causing a greater rapprochement, it appears, between the EU and Turkey. The European Union is courting Turkey, giving them more money to help shelter Syrian refugees, to help them obviously deal with the problem, but also to help prevent the flow of refugees out, taking rickety boats, working with traffickers, and of course flooding Europe. What does this mean for EU-Turkish relations? And what about the civil liberties issue? We're hearing again the EU chastising the Turkish government for repressing civil liberties, for cracking down on press freedom. To what extent will that complicate their rapprochement?
First of all, Carol, as you mentioned, Turkey deserves a lot of credit for the assistance it has given to Syrian refugees, housing, I think at this point, more than 2 million of them at a cost of almost $8 billion to the country. It is one of the largest humanitarian undertakings of this conflict and really is a very generous gesture on the part of the Turkish people, and also highlights really the inaction of the United States and the European countries to have let it get to this point where so many people have left Syria. I think something like half of the country is displaced. But this situation highlights something that I think runs through all of the topics that we've been talking about, which is a prioritization issue that faces both Turks and foreign powers dealing with Turkey, the U.S. and the EU in particular, and the trade-offs between short-term interests and long-term ones. In the short term, the EU, which finds itself overwhelmed and politically challenged, and perhaps even facing the prospect that the EU might fall apart around the refugee issue, is trying desperately to stem the flow. And what it's effectively doing is it's paying off Turkey to try to keep as many of these refugees within Turkey as possible. And it's also, as part of this, turning a blind eye to some of the authoritarian issues that have been taking place within Turkey. In fact, the EU has been one of the leading critics of the violation of the rule of law, of the violation of media freedoms that has happened in Turkey. And part of the deal they seem to have struck, in addition to giving more money to Turkey to deal with the refugees, is dialing back their criticism. So here they're trading short-term interests on refugees against long-term interests in the health of Turkey's democracy. It's the same thing that the U.S. has been doing in trading Turkish cooperation and access to its basis in the fight against ISIS for a long-term interest in the health of Turkish state and society.
The last word to you, Kadir Ustun. Do you see it that way, a trade-off going on between, for example, the EU's interest in having Turkey shelter more refugees, giving them more money, and then being less demanding with respect to Turkey's view vis-a-vis rule of law, freedom of expression?
Well, I think Turkey's approach regarding you outlined it really well, regarding the refugees. One thing they've been insistent on is to have a humanitarian perspective on this. For instance, the prime minister said that we're not going to have these camps that will be sponsored by the EU. We want a humane solution to this, and it's not only about the money. But the recent rapprochement, as you mentioned, may lead to some sort of visa liberalization for Turkey, etc., which was already actually in the works. It's a 3-year process. But I suspect we're not going to see a big EU-Turkey rapprochement politically, because the EU has deep suspicions about Turkey and they're very scared about the refugees. Turkey doesn't see it that way. But I don't think it might help move some of the negotiations for membership forward.
It will help, you think?
It will help, but it will probably remain limited. And I don't quite think that there is such a trade-off. You know, hundreds of thousands of people have been pouring into Europe, and it's an urgent crisis. The scale is just unprecedented. And they have been critical of Turkey. There are serious, of course, issues regarding media freedom and other issues in Turkey, rule of law. But let's remember that we've had elections and we've had instability. So there are many things that we can't quite elaborate now in this short amount of time. But I don't think there is such a deal between Turkey and EU. EU is looking for its interests in stemming the flow of refugees into its territory, with the exception of Germany. But that crisis will not simply
overshadow their concerns on press freedom and so forth.
I don't think so.
Well, the debate on Turkey's leadership and direction continues. But for now, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Kadir Üstün, Executive Director at the Foundation for Political, Economic, and Social Research, and Blaise Michtal. He's Director of the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Thanks to both of you for your terrific insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Jiang Wang. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.